overrule prior precedent of the court in Settlemyer versus State, and to rule that we had a right to cross-examine the technical supervisor in this DWI case, the technical supervisor who compounded the materials, who checked the machines if it was done, and cross-examine her about the facts of how she did that and whether or not it was properly done. Now, in Settlemyer, the court said that that was not testimonial evidence. And it may not have been in Settlemyer. But in this case, we objected to the offering of the substitute technical supervisor on the grounds that it violated the right of confrontation of the defendant under the Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution and the Texas Constitution. And we objected under Washington, Crawford versus Washington, that we had a right to cross-examine the witness who actually did the work. Now, when we look at what is done in the preparation of the technical supervisor and what she does, we have to look, I think, first at the administrative code and see what her duties are. And when we look at the administrative code said it is the technical supervisor's duty to supervise the area where the machine is, to be sure that the samples used to test the machine are properly compounded, and that the machine is working properly on the date in question. Now, the administrative code says that she is the custodian of the record. And what she what the administrative code does is the administrative code sets out what are the duties of a technical supervisor. This is not a case where, I think it can be distinguished from the DNA cases where they just say, well, somebody profiled the DNA, and so therefore the DNA evidence comes in. Because here, there is only one purpose of the technical supervisor, according to the administrative code, and that is to be sure that the machine is operating properly, to do the test on the machine, to prepare the liquid that is ultimately used in the test samples, and to certify that the location is proper, and also to see that there are the right materials at the location for testing. But forensic evidence, conversely, is evidence that can be provided by any lab, prepared by any lab, and may or may not have any relation to the question that will ultimately come to trial. But the primary function of the technical supervisor is to provide the technical, administrative, and supervisory expertise in safeguarding the scientific integrity of the breath alcohol testing program and to assure the breath alcohol testing program's acceptability for evidentiary purposes. And that is what gives the defendant the right to examine that technical supervisor, is because the duties of the technical supervisor is to be sure that she has complied with all the rules for compounding. And you can't do this in this case. You couldn't do it by examining another technical supervisor, because he's looking at records that she prepared. And she prepared those records for the purposes of being able to testify that that was properly done.
What evidence is there in the record that he was looking at records that she prepared versus he was looking at records that were actually generated by the intoxilizer itself?
Well, we cross-examined him on that question. We asked him, were you the technical supervisor who did this? And he said, no, I was not.
Didn't he agree that he assisted in the compounding of the sample?
He said that he and some other technical supervisor assisted Laura Fuller in compounding of the liquid. That's what he said. And then he said he was relying on what she put in her statements about whether or not the machine was tested, tested at the proper temperature, tested in the location where it was. That was all the testimony that would have come from Laura Fuller. And then he just said, in relying on the evidence that indicates her statements prepared ahead of time, the reports, if you will, he relied on that in reaching the conclusion that the machine was operating properly. And quite frankly, that's what we're entitled to examine her about. You're entitled to examine a witness about the things they do to be sure that they have done things properly.
In asking this court to overrule Settlemyer, clearly other courts have followed that opinion. And I know you cite a dissenting opinion, I believe, out of San Antonio.
Yes.
Do you have any majority opinion as authority that Settlemyer is wrong?
Not out of Texas, Your Honor. I think that Bullcumin, which came after Settlemyer, changed the landscape, at least at the federal level, from what Settlemyer says the landscape is. Bullcumin said unequivocally, you cannot bring in another analysis to testify to what the first analysis did. You have to bring in that first analysis or you deprive the defendant of his right to cross-examine. Now, the court in deciding Settlemyer relied on a footnote in Melendez-Diaz. And in relying on that footnote, when you read that footnote, and as I read the opinion out of this court, what they said in Melendez-Diaz is, we're not saying you always have to bring in the person that did this work. You have to look at the purpose of the work. What is the reason that the work was done? For example, if you have an autopsy that is prepared, in every case in Texas where there is an unusual death, there has to be an autopsy prepared. The purpose of that autopsy is not testimonial. Now, certainly, if the state goes to offer that autopsy into evidence, they don't just get to offer it. They have to bring in somebody to testify that the autopsy was done and that it was done properly and that based on that results of that autopsy that it's now admissible or that this is the cause of death. I think that's a circumstance that's even closer. When you look at what the administrative code says about the duties of the technical supervisor, the administrative code makes the technical supervisor the custodian of the evidence for the state. The custodian who will tell the court that this was properly done and therefore the machine was working properly. A lot of times, I know an example might be if you Google something, sometimes you get an answer and sometimes you get a different answer. Well, that's generated by the computer. So you have to look at who prepared the answer. And in this case, they had Laurie Tomlin, and she was gone from Swift's, and so they sent in a substitute. But that deprived the defendant of his right to cross-examine the one who did the work on the machine. And that's what our argument is, very simply.
So anytime the person that did the work on the machine dies or becomes incapable, there's a gap in proof under which a defendant cannot be convicted?
Well, I think so. I'll be honest with you. I think that technical supervisor has to be there to be cross-examined about how she did the things that were done by her only, not by someone else. If, for example, a technical supervisor went to a location and it might be a dark and stormy day in northwest Texas and it was colder than the temperatures set out and she calibrated the machine anyway, that would be a false calibration. And there are other circumstances that could enter into it. And the way she did the calibration itself comes into question and should be subject to cross-examination by a defendant who is charged with a crime. to say that that the evidence comes in simply because it came from a machine after somebody prepared that machine, why aren't you entitled to cross-examine the person who prepared the machine? And I think that the law should be that we were entitled to cross-examine Fuller, to cross-examine her about the creation of the records. Suppose somebody creates a false record. Well, you know, I had to be in the Court of Appeals today, and, you know, so I didn't have time to properly do that, but I'll just show that I've done it. Then that's, and then the other technical supervisor comes in and says, oh, yeah, she did it, and therefore the test is admissible? Why? Why is that not a violation of the defendant's right to cross-examine the witness that prepared it? And so for that reason, we believe that this action, and because of the, what the administrative code, which has just been revised, says, we believe that this action is evidentiary, that this action's sole purpose of the supervising technical supervisor, the sole purpose of that person is to testify in court that the machine was operating properly on the date the test was administered. In this case, she checked the machine after the test was done. The same day. Certainly, you know, we are entitled to ask her, what did you find? How did it show? What were the readings? Was the mixture correct? You know,
don't you have records that the intoxilizer itself generated that the witness did review, that you would have had a chance to review, that would have confirmed what he was testifying to?
No,
or
Your Honor.
Refuted it?
No, Your Honor. There was no records introduced. There were no records produced that show what the what was
did
done.
Did you ask for them?
Pardon me?
Did trial counsel ask for them?
I don't recall that we did, Judge. I don't recall what our discovery motions were. As a matter of fact, the discovery in compliance with the local rules was provided to the state by the state to the defense. In this case, we knew who the technical supervisor was. And that was the information that we had, and that was all the information we had, was who she was. Now, so for that reason, though, we believe that the actions of the technical supervisor are testimonial in nature, as required by law. And so under Bullcoming, that makes her appearance at trial cannot be substituted. Certainly, if there's an unavailable witness, there might be some circumstance where it would. Now, the second issue that we come to in this case was the issue of the one of the enhancements. They alleged in the indictment itself that there was an enhancement of driving while intoxicated that was returned against the defendant. And that was one of the enhanced offense. When they introduced the judgment said driving boating while intoxicated. Now, this court has already ruled in a writ case, number 215-277-CR, that was a clerical error that could have been corrected because the trial judge said it was a clerical error, but they didn't offer the trial judge. They didn't bring the trial judge to testify that he made a clerical error in that judgment. And that
we take judicial notice of that finding from the previous case that was filed in this court?
I think you can, but that doesn't mean that the jury could. The jury had a judgment, and they were the judges of the facts, and the judgment said driving, boating while intoxicated. That was the proof. Now, the state introduced that judgment over our objection. Furthermore, then the state reopens after we raised our issue of no evidence by a motion to the court and asked the court to find the defendant guilty of the Class A misdemeanor, then the state reopened. And at that time, in my opinion, they compounded their error by offering into evidence the complaint and information in the case. Because the court is clear that complaints and informations are hearsay, and they're not admissible in court. You have no right to confront the affiant at that time, and therefore they're not admissible.
Isn't that generally in the context, though, of proving the underlying offense?
That's correct.
But they weren't using it for that purpose
here.
Yes,
they were. They said they were. They said they were trying to clarify the confusion that I created in the mind of the jury as to whether boating, driving while intoxicated was an offense.
Right, but they weren't seeking to convict on that offense because it was a prior conviction.
Well, they were seeking to maintain jurisdiction as a felony case in the felony court. They had already alleged it, so that gave the felony court jurisdiction, and now they were seeking the enhancement that would maintain and hold that felony conviction as opposed to reducing it to a Class A misdemeanor.
But I guess my point is that the reason it's hearsay, or the line of cases that say that the complaint is not admissible, is because you're not supposed to use that for the purpose of convicting them of that offense. And that this wasn't used in that way in this situation.
I understand, but you're entitled to confront the witness. If I offer an affidavit against the defendant is entitled to confront the witness. That affidavit is not admissible and that's the best you could say about a complaint and an information that simply recites the complaint is certainly not admissible. It's hearsay. It violates the right to confrontation.
It's only hearsay if it's used to prove the truth of the matter asserted therein. And it wasn't used for the truth of the matter asserted therein. It was used as proof as to what the conviction, the underlying facts were supporting the conviction itself.
And that was the truth of the matter. The truth of the matter was that they wanted to prove that it was a driving while intoxicated rather than a boating while intoxicated. Their information that they introduced the judgment on that information said driving, boating while intoxicated. There was a way to overcome that, and they didn't do it. They could have called the judge who entered the judgment, said, "What happened, judge?" And he could have told them, and he could have said, "That was a clerical error." And then that would have solved their problem. But you can't go around the evidence that's admissible by introducing inadmissible evidence. We had no opportunity to cross-examine the persons that prepared those affidavits or informations.
All right, Mr. Marsh, I believe your time has passed, and so we'll ask Ms. Tomlin to come up. Thank you. And let's give Ms. Tomlin another minute because we did go quite a bit over in the last argument. Let's give her a minute to get set up here. All right, thank you. Proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. This court should affirm the trial court's denial of the motion for directed verdict and affirm appellant's conviction. Starting with the driving/boating while intoxicated, this court did rule on this same issue last month in Ex parte Hernandez. And by same issue, it was the exact same case filed by Mr. Marsh. And Mr. Marsh here and in that 1107-2 writ argued that the underlying offense was void and he relied on the concurrence in Ex parte McDonald, a CCA case out of 2015 that was unpublished. This court found that the boating was a clerical error and that his reliance on McDonald was misplaced because McDonald dealt with an involuntary plea and an offense that truly did not exist, not a clerical error. And regardless, the evidence showed that he was twice convicted of a DWI, and it was reasonable for the jury to conclude that based on the combined and cumulative evidence put in front of them. So that judgment should not be void. And addressing the complaint and information, the state did introduce the complaint and information to clear up confusion. Defense counsel argued that driving slash boating was an offense, and to counteract that argument, the state brought in the complaint information. The defense counsel also asked the police officer questions about driving while intoxicated, boating while intoxicated, entering more confusion into the minds of the jury. So it was relevant for the state to bring in the complaint information to clear that up, and it wasn't hearsay as they were public record, and as Justice Sutterth was asking about, this wasn't to prove that appellant was drunk on the night of the offense for this felony DWI. It was just to clear up the driving slash boating confusion. And this wasn't a case where the state was bringing in a complaint information for a case that was dismissed or a case that appellant was found not guilty of. This was a case where the judgment had already been entered into evidence. The jurors had already seen the judgment, and this was just a complaint information to clear that up. Moving to the confrontation clause issue, to briefly clear this up, it was Lori Fuller that was the technical supervisor, not Laura Tomlin, who is me. So just to clear that up, appellant asserts that this change in the administrative code has changed the law, but the fact that the wording in the administrative code has changed does not change the reasoning in Settlemyer and does not change this court's interpretation of Melendez-Diaz that found that documents prepared in the regular course of equipment maintenance may qualify as non-testimonial. And this change came in January of 2015, and since January 15 of 2015, Lara v. State out of El Paso in 2015, and Hysenage v. State out of Eastland, that was actually a transferred case from this court to Eastland in 2015, both still followed the reasoning in Settlemyer, and this was after the administrative code change. Appellant talked about the duties of the technical supervisor in the administrative code in his argument today, and those duties can also be performed by Terry Robinson. Terry Robinson can look at these maintenance records and decide and interpret them and determine if the machine was working at the time. And not only that, but Terry Robinson testified that he actually helped make the sample that was in the intoxilizer that was used the night that appellant was pulled over and gave a breath sample. And as far as the primary purpose to have appellant argued, as far as expertise, Terry Robinson can also have that expertise and testified based off these machine-generated records whether the machine was working that night. And that's why Settlemyer has found that there can be what Lara v. State calls a surrogate technical supervisor. And this case is exactly like Settlemyer v. State out of this court from 2010, as in that case, it was Lori Fuller who was a technical supervisor that testified instead of the one that was assigned to the specific machine. And this court found that there was no confrontation clause violation, and there's none here, because Terry Robinson helped make the batch of the reference sample, reviewed the records, and testified that this machine was in working condition on the night of the offense. Appellant is arguing that Settlemyer should be overturned, citing the Boutang dissent, and there I have not found any courts that have filed the Boutang dissent, and instead several courts have followed Settlemyer. Lara and Hysenage that I mentioned, and also several published cases out of 2013, Beard v. State in Waco, Alcaraz v. State out of San Antonio, and Boutang v. State out of San Antonio, and back in 2000, Henderson v. State out of Austin also found there could be a surrogate technical supervisor. Appellant relies on Bullcoming v. State, but Bullcoming v. State is not merely interpreting machine-generated data. And Hysenage v. State spoke of Bullcoming and talked about how in Bullcoming there were notes that analysts wrote on the lab reports, and it was not just a printout that was being interpreted. Here we have Terry Robinson interpreting a machine-generated data. What I see in this case law is you have Melendez-Diaz with drug reports, Bullcoming, which was blood, but it wasn't a computer-generated report, Birch v. State that had drugs, and these drugs and blood where the analysts are actually touching the evidence and doing tests on them seem like they need to have the lab analyst there. But when you look at Settlemyer and its progeny, in this case, it's computer-generated data where there can be a surrogate. And that's true in Paredes v. State out of the Court of Criminal Appeals from 2015. It's in the state's brief. And that is DNA analysis, but it finds that a testifying expert can rely on computer-generated data because it's different than a laboratory analyst's report.
Okay, I want to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Marsh, and that is there anywhere in the record that we can look that will support his position that the testifying witness relied upon handwritten notes or something other than the documentation generated by the instrument itself?
No, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything in the record showing that. I think the record shows that he had computer-generated results from the intoxilizer, and his testimony was based on that. I don't remember anything else like that. I think I would have noticed it, considering Bull Cummings says if there's written notes on there, it is a problem, and I don't think there are in this case. There's no evidence of that. So Paredes also finds that computer-generated data comes from a computer that cannot be cross-examined, and unlike a witness that can be cross-examined. And that's why in this case, in Settlemyer and Paredes, you don't have to have the actual person that was supervising printing out the computer-generated data. Even if this court were to find that there was error, the state is arguing there'd be no harm under a constitutional error harm analysis. Their appellant asserts that the breath test was the only evidence of intoxication here, but that's not true. Appellant was driving the wrong way down the road, said he was driving the wrong way because he was had been drinking. He was unsteady, slurred, smelled of alcohol, said he had been drinking at a bar, failed the standardized field sobriety test, made several admissions on the video that he felt buzzed, he felt the alcohol, and he was a 6 on a 1 to 10 scale of intoxication. And here the indictment alleged intoxication, and the jury charge defined that as above 0.08 or loss of use of mental or physical faculties. So here the jury wasn't moved from a state of non-persuasion to persuasion with this breath test, as there was already plenty of evidence to prove that he had lost the normal use of his mental or physical faculties. And Langham v. State out of the Court of Criminal Appeals from 2010 has factors as far as what you look at for confrontation clause harm analysis. And here the breath test was not that important because of all this other evidence of intoxication. The breath test was cumulative of the other evidence of intoxication. The breath test was corroborated by that evidence. The defense case, the state's case was strong. And while the state did mention the breath test 4 times in closing statement, it was part of describing the overall state of the evidence, and there was more of a focus actually on the prior judgment that is in appellant's issue number 1. Appellant argues in his brief about the admissibility of the breath test, but the state will simply say under the Harrell v. State and Ryan v. State predicate, the state did prove what was needed to get in the breath test, that Terry Robinson was certified by DPS as a technical supervisor, knew that the reference sample was correct, testified to the underlying scientific theory of the intoxilizer, and that he maintained the records with his 2 coworkers, and that the instrument was operating correctly on at the time the test was taken. There were no problems with the sample, and the underlying scientific theory was properly applied. And if there are no more questions, the state can conclude. All right. The state prays that this court affirm the trial court's denial of appellant's motion for directed verdict and confirm his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tomlin. Mr. Marsh.
Well, in regard to the issue that the state raises, I believe there is testimony in the record that Robinson relied on the evidence gathered by, or the evidence gathered by Fuller, or the statements that she made that she checked the machine on the dates in question, because he said he didn't know that, as a matter of fact, that he wasn't there. Now, they say that the introduction of the, you know, they say that this issue was decided in Laura, and it was. And that Laura case was transferred from Fort Worth to El Paso. And the El Paso court said, we follow the precedent of the second court, and we're bound to do that, and so we affirm Laura. And that's what the El Paso court said in Laura. That was, a case that that we appealed out of Denton County. That case is up on PDR, and we haven't heard anything on that yet. But anyway, Laura is pending before the Court of Criminal Appeals. When the state offered the complaint and information to clear up the judgment that was entered, and the whole purpose of us challenging the judgment that was entered was because it said what it did. It was a judgment that was entered saying the defendant was guilty of driving, boating while intoxicated. We raised that issue at the trial level, pre-trial and during the trial. The state then sought to bolster it. The state, according to the writ out of the Hernandez writ on the misdemeanor case, the state had a good way to do that, and that was to call the trial judge. You can't substitute bad evidence for good evidence to achieve the result you want. They had good evidence available to them, and that was to call the trial judge and put him up on the witness stand and have him look at that judgment and say that it was clerical error. In the misdemeanor case,
wouldn't he base his opinion on the complaint in those very documents that you think are inadmissible? I mean, wouldn't that be part of the basis of his conclusion?
Well, it probably would be, but it doesn't change the fact that you can't get in inadmissible evidence and use that to prove a conviction when it's not there. It doesn't matter what someone might say about, in the case of a complaint and information, unsworn testimony offered to prove that this was a driving while intoxicated case. The way they had to do that, in my humble opinion, was to bring the judge down and let him testify that it was clerical error. This court asked for finding fact conclusion of law after the judge denied our writ. We didn't back off. The court asked for a finding fact conclusion of law. They filed one. It came up, and I suppose relying on the opinion, and I didn't see any of that, but it was never provided to me. I suppose the judge entered a finding fact conclusion of law that he made a clerical error. And therefore, this court said it could be corrected. And, an example, and I'll just say this, the court said, we rely on the attorney's bill. Well, you can't rely on my bill. I put up there at the number what the judge told me I was appointed on. You know, that's not sworn testimony. I swear that I submitted the bill. And I swear that that's case on, but that's not sworn testimony that's admissible in court just because I swore to it, even in another proceeding, if you say you swore to it. You know, even if the judge paid me off of that bill, it's not admissible evidence. And so, you know, you've got to use evidence that's competent. And the competent evidence in this case to prove up that prior conviction was someone to testify. Someone, not necessarily the judge, someone to testify that they were in the court, that they had something to do with that plea, they had something to do with that case, and that case was a driving while intoxicated case, because that's what they alleged in the complaint, in the indictment in this case. But they did not allege driving boating while intoxicated like the judgment said. And there had not been any non-pro-tunk judgment entered that changed the judgment that they introduced at trial. And for that was error. Thank you. And we ask the court to reverse this case.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh.
Thank you.
Ms. Tomlin, we appreciate y'all coming to town to argue in front of the Second Court of Appeals today. We also appreciate all the briefing you've done and your arguments you presented today. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused, and we will adjourn court now.
See all y'all.
Beyond the Court of Appeals of the Second District of Texas, now stands adjourned.